ما بعد، يقول الله في كتابه الكريم: بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. قل يا أهل الكتاب تعالوا إلى كلمة سواء بيننا وبينكم ألا نعبد إلا الله ولا نشرك به شيئا ولا يتخذ بعضنا بعضا أربابا من دون الله. The first of our loud salawat in honor of Rasulullah Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. The second loud salawat in honor of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Allahumma salli. The third with your loudest voices in honor of the Imam of our time, Imam Sahib al-Asr wa zaman. Allah. Respected scholars, brothers and sisters, salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Karbala and the Holocaust, two of the most horrific genocides that have occurred in the history of humanity. Whenever any genocide occurred in the history of humanity, there's a need for us to reflect on that genocide. For that genocide affects millions upon millions of people's lives. Until today, you find that Karbala and the Holocaust both affect the lives of millions from two of the most important religions in the world today. The religion of Islam and the religion of Judaism continue to mourn and commemorate and grieve over the calamitous events that took place on the southern plains of Iraq and across Europe in World War II. And you find that these two communities continue to honor those who were killed horrifically. If you go anywhere in the world, you'll find that many members of the Muslim community continue to honor what took place on the plains of Karbala. Likewise, you find that if you go across the world, you'll see many members of the Jewish community who do not forget the crimes that took place across Europe in World War II. No doubt you find that both of these areas have to be dissected in depth. Sadly, nobody until today has done an examination of the similarities of what led to the Holocaust and an examination of the similarities of what led to Karbala. It's unbelievable that when a person examines the circumstances that led to the Holocaust and the circumstances that led to Karbala, how history repeats itself. As in, yes, Karbala took place in the formative period of the religion of Islam, in the first century of the religion of Islam. And the Holocaust took place just under a century ago. But when you examine the similarities between the two, it is quite unbelievable how Jewish studies and Islamic studies departments until today have not structured a course at their universities called Karbala and the Holocaust. There are many prestigious universities in the world that have a Jewish studies department or a Hebrew studies department. There are many prestigious universities in the world that have an Islamic studies department or an Arabic studies department. Yet when you examine these university courses, you won't find that there is a course or a module that's offered where a person is able to look at the similarities or the shared grief that exists between the Muslim community and the Jewish community. As in the Quran highlighted from the very beginning that we should always try and look for our similarities with the people of the book. When the ayah was revealed, chapter 3, verse 64, قُلْ يَا أَهْلَ الْكِتَابِ تَعَالَوْا, say to the people of the book, either the Jews who have the Torah, or the Christians who have the Bible, or the Muslims who have the Quran, إِلَىٰ كَلِمَةٍ سَوَاءٍ بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَكُمْ, say to them that come to a joint word between us and you. We may have differences between Islam and Judaism, but we also have areas of similarity. And one of them is that when there is an area or an incident where we lost lives, where people were oppressed, where families were destroyed, where communities saw children massacred in front of them, then there is a need for us and the Jewish community to get together as in today in Britain and across the world, there is heightened anti-Semitism as well as heightened Islamophobia. Whether it's in Pittsburgh or in New Zealand, the reality is that what takes place when one human being is killed should affect all of us. If members of the Jewish community are killed in a synagogue, it should affect me today. If members of the Muslim community are affected in New Zealand, it should affect me today. And the only way that it's going to have an effect is when the two religions look at incidents in their history, whether the incident took place 1,000 years ago, or the incident took place only 80 odd years ago, both communities need to come together and examine the Holocaust and what Nazis did in Germany and across Europe, in Austria and Poland, can be found in GCSE curriculums everywhere. Until today, you'll find that there are GCSE curriculums where our sons and daughters study Nazi Germany. A-level curriculums where people study Nazi Germany. University degrees where people study Nazi Germany and what took place with the Holocaust. That's important because there is a need for us to understand the darkest spots in the history of humanity. Whether it was Rwanda, Bosnia, Iraq, Germany, there is a need for us. But likewise, Karbala has to also be in these curriculums as well. If I'm going to study the Holocaust in GCSE or A-levels, and I offer it as a thesis, likewise, there is another genocide which is similar to what took place in the Holocaust. Believe you me, tonight, when we examine the similarities of what led to the Holocaust and what led to Karbala, and what took place in the Holocaust and what took place in Karbala, and the aftermath of the Holocaust and the aftermath of Karbala, you will realize that the resemblance is unerring. And indeed, a resemblance that causes goosebumps in the life and the body of the human being when they hear the similarities between the two. Therefore, tonight, let's examine the similarities between what took place in the Holocaust and what took place in Karbala. And I'd like to do this in the following stages. Number one, how similar were the two leaders of both events? And how did their psychological makeup lead them to what took place? Number two, how did two treaties get broken in the lead up to the Holocaust and the lead up to Karbala? Number three, how were their personalities who paved the way for the Holocaust to happen and for Karbala to happen? Number four, how did the Holocaust and Karbala both witness the massacre of women and children innocently? Number five, how about those who lived to tell the tale of both? Who were the ones who narrated, either in their diaries or in their sermons, what took place in both incidents? Number six, and of the utmost importance, where was God in the Holocaust? And where was God in Karbala? And is it better to have an atheist opinion on such tragedies or an opinion of a believer when examining such tragedies? Number seven, did the religions of both genocides learn from those genocides, or did they mete out their own holocausts and their own Karbalas later on? And of the utmost importance in conclusion, the survivors of the Holocaust and the survivors of Karbala, what did they ask for in recompense? And what is the difference between the two? Let's examine this and dissect this topic in complete depth. The first area of similarity between the Holocaust and Karbala were the two leaders at the helm when both genocides happened. If you study Adolf Hitler and you study Yazid bin Muawiyah, the similarities between the two of them are quite unbelievable. Adolf Hitler, on the first level, from a young age, saw war right in front of him. Normally, when a person is young and witnesses war, they have two reactions to it. Either there are those who react by never wanting to see bloodshed or war again, as in when you see people mercilessly killed in front of you, like Hitler saw in World War I. How old was Hitler in World War I? Hitler in World War I was 25 years of age. In his early 20s, Hitler saw World War I take place. Austria, Poland, Germany, lots of lives massacred in front of him. Normally, if a person sees this, one way is that that person will completely never want to see war again. Because they see that there are innocent people who are being killed because of bombings. They see that there are people in shelters and bunkers. They see that there are people who are homeless with no one to look after them. You find that one group, when they see war, never want to go near war ever again. There's a second who can't wait to see death again. When they saw death at a young age, they got used to seeing death. They found it normal to see death. If I see a dead body in front of me, one reaction may be, I never want to see this again. Another may be, if it's that normal to see blood, then show me more blood. If I could grow up in my 20s, and I could see that blood is being shed, therefore, when I call for war again, it makes no difference to me. As in, why is it that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon his family, on many occasions, wanted the Muslims to remain away from the world of war? Because the world of war can make you a cold human being. And it could also destroy you psychologically. Hitler was in his 20s when he saw war at a young age. What did that mean? That meant that he wouldn't mind exterminating fellow human beings. He would not mind seeing that people are sent to dungeons, that people are sent to gas chambers, that people are taken and never seen again, because war has that effect at a young age. Likewise, you find Yazid bin Muawiyah. Yazid bin Muawiyah was 13 when the Battle of Siffin took place. When the Battle of Siffin took place, how old was Yazid? Because if you ask many people, Yazid, how old was he? Yazid was 36 in Karbala, maybe 38. Yazid was in his late 30s when he was the caliph in Sham. You found that when he had died, Yazid earlier in his life had seen war. War had become very normal for Yazid. When he saw his father's actions in the Battle of Siffin, you know, thousands died at Siffin because of his father. His father initiated a battle claiming that I've come out to avenge what happened to the third Khalifa. When Yazid saw his father finding it normal to kill, why would Yazid then be someone cold-blooded? As in, from a young age, Yazid sees that it's extremely normal for Muslims to kill each other, for Muslims to behead each other, and not just any Muslim. If my father could fight the son of Abu Talib, then I'll fight the grandson of Abu Talib. If my father is willing to butcher the grandsons of Rasulullah, because Imam al-Hassan al-Hussein were at Siffin, they were 20, how old were they at Siffin? 33 and 34. If my father finds it normal that he fights an army with Imam Ali at the helm, with Ammar bin Yasir, with Imam al-Hassan, with Imam al-Hussein, then what's wrong with me exterminating their lives? If my father was willing to cut the very rope of Muhammad's message that was still alive, then likewise I will do the same. Likewise, in the same way Hitler saw war at a young age, Yazid saw war at a young age. Number two, Hitler came from an adulterous, illegitimate background ancestry. Hitler did not know who his grandfather was. His father, Alois, had three different people who claimed that they were his father. As in, when a person grows in an environment where they don't know who their father is or who their grandfather is, it's the worst feeling. Imagine that you walk around in a school, everybody knows your surname, everybody knows each other's surname, except your one. You're called, for example, Ali, son of his father. Ali, son of his father, on the register does not look good. As in, if I hear that this person's surname is Muhammad, that one is Stevens, that one is Patel, that one is so-and-so, but yours is what? Ali, son of his father. Hitler's father, Alois, did not know who his father was. Hitler's grandfather was known for illegitimate relations. And therefore, you found that this had an effect on Hitler. Because psychologically, when a person grows up, you don't want to grow up in an environment where you don't know who your grandfather was. As in, you don't want to be in an environment where there are many different claimants for who could be your grandfather. You look at the same with Yazid bin Muawiyah, similar to Hitler. Yazid's grandfather was as adulterous as Hitler's grandfather. And his adultery had the effect where its ripples continued until the 10th of Muharram. Why? Abu Sufyan had committed an act of adultery that would continue with the Muslim community forever. Abu Sufyan committed zina with a lady by the name of Sumayya. Sumayya was at the time married to a person by the name of Ubayd. That person by the name of Ubayd, he did not know that his wife was having relations with who? Was having relations with Abu Sufyan. While she was having relations, she became pregnant. When she became pregnant in this illegitimate relationship, she gave birth to a boy. His name was Ziyad. Ziyad was born from an illegitimate relationship. What would happen later on? You'd find that later on, Ziyad, what would people call Ziyad? Until today, if you look at the books of history, you will always find that Ziyad is known as Ziyad ibn Abihi. Ziyad, the son of his father. That Ziyad, son of his father, why would they call him the son of his father? Because there's no way that you could say Ziyad is the son of Abu Sufyan. If you know that your father had committed adultery with your mom, you're not going to be proud of coming out with that. You found that that Ziyad, who originally was with Amir al-Mu'mineen, who did he move on to? He moved on to the side later on of Muawiyah. Muawiyah, when Ziyad moved to his side, Muawiyah proudly would come out because he knew that people were saying that, listen, this Ziyad is as much your brother as he is the son of your dad. Muawiyah blatantly came out. He said, stop calling him Ziyad bin Abi. His name is Ziyad, the son of Abu Sufyan. Imagine, normally you would morally be proud of your ancestry. It would be immoral for a person to be proud of an adulterous relationship that takes place. That Ziyad has a son who becomes the commander of the armed forces in Karbala. What's his name? Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, therefore, and Yazid bin Muawiyah are first cousins through zina. Like Hitler had seen war and had a psychological effect of an adulterous background, Yazid likewise the same as Hitler. Yazid had seen war from a young age. Yazid had been part of a family tree that had an adulterous background that has an effect on him. Therefore, the first similarity between Karbala and the Holocaust were the two arrogant leaders involved. The second similarity, there were treaties that were broken which led to both of these occurrences, both of these genocides. Which treaty was broken when it came to Hitler? The Treaty of Versailles. How many of you have studied the Treaty of Versailles? The Treaty of Versailles tried to put a limit on the power of Germany. In 1919, the treaty was signed. When countries sign a treaty, or when leaders sign a treaty, the aim is to try and bring the community together, to try and stay away from having a possibility of more bloodshed or more war. The Treaty of Versailles, until today, what's it called? It's called the War Guilt Treaty. It was a treaty that was enacted because of what Germany had done in World War I. It was a limitation on Germany's power. What did the treaty say? That Germany could no longer make these alliances with others, which makes it more powerful for itself. That Germany, number two, would not invade other countries like it had done in World War I. Then number three, Germany would have a disarmament, that these weapons that Germany has, there would be a stop to these weapons. Number four, that Germany would have reparations that it would have to pay back. £6.6 billion was owed because of World War I. Germany had to make sure that all of these were paid back. You found that all of these were in the Treaty of Versailles. Who broke them? Hitler. When he broke them, it led to the Holocaust. How? Hitler turned around. He looked at the Treaty of Versailles. When he saw it, what did he say? Why should I follow this treaty? Each one of the terms of the treaty, I'm going to break. What did he break? Number one, he was not allowed to make an alliance with another country. Straight away, he made an alliance with Austria, made him more powerful. Because you all know, Hitler's origin was where Austria, as in many people will turn around and say Hitler's German, his origin of birth is where? Austria. The first line in the Treaty of Versailles was that you're not meant to make any more alliances. Hitler straight away made an alliance with Austria, number one. Number two, you don't invade any other country. You've signed this. This is meant to be honored. Did Hitler invade any other country? Straight away, he went and invaded Poland. Okay. Number two, when he invaded Poland, number three, you have reparations to pay. Germany has reparations to pay. And these reparations, which have to be paid continuously because of what Germany done in World War I. £6.6 billion had to be repaid by Germany. Hitler said, forget reparations. We're not paying anything back. And who's going to try and stop me? One by one in this treaty, I'm going to break it down. Further than that, you don't build your army. I said, what do you mean don't build my army? He remilitarized the Rhineland. He continued to build his army. The whole of the Treaty of Versailles was what? Was completely ripped apart. That treaty, when it was ripped apart, you found that it led to the Holocaust. Why? Because now Hitler knew, I've invaded Poland. And not only have I invaded Poland, I've also made an alliance with Austria. At the same time, nobody can ask me for money. I'll continue to build my money. From then onwards, there is no Jew who's going to stand in my way. I'll persecute the Jewish community. I'll do whatever I want to them. Burn their synagogues. Break their businesses. The moment that treaty was destroyed, it led to what took place at Holocaust. Likewise with Yazid, the treaty Muawiyah, his father, had signed with Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Muhammad. Imam al-Hasan and Muawiyah had a treaty with each other. Treaty of Versailles led to the Holocaust because it was broken. Treaty of Imam al-Hasan with Muawiyah, the moment each clause was broken, Karbala was moments away. What were the clauses in the treaty of Imam al-Hasan with Muawiyah? Number one, you stop the cursing of my father from the pulpits. Imam, Amir al-Mu'mineen, every Friday, from the 40th year after Hijrah, for 50 years, was cursed every time in the Friday prayer. Yes. Children were brought up hating Imam Ali alayhi salam, hating his sons, Mughira bin Shu'bah, and who? Subhanallah, Ziyad bin Abi, the illegitimate son of Abu Sufyan, would come on the Friday prayers, and they would curse Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam al-Hasan with Muawiyah, he made it clear. He said to Muawiyah, if we're going to have a treaty of peace between us, then the first condition is that you stop the cursing of my father from the pulpits. I ask all of you, did he stop the cursing? Not even stop the cursing. Even you find in books of non-Shia that the cursing did not stop. The cursing had continued to the extent that there are people who come years later who are asked to curse Ali, son of Abu Talib. Therefore, the first condition of the treaty, they made sure was broken. Second condition, that you do not kill the Shia of my father. Okay. Second condition, that my father has a group of followers. They are known as Shia Ali, the Shia of Ali. They are the likes of who? Hujr bin Adi, Rushad al-Hajari, Amr bin Hamaq al-Khuza'i. Others such as Maitham al-Tammar. Others who, for example, were alive from the companions of Ahlul Bayt. These Shia of Ali, you do not kill them. If we're going to sign a treaty with each other, then you leave the Shia. Why? Because he had persecuted the Shia. He had drawn a line in this treaty. Did Muawiyah stop the killing of the Shia of Ali? Not at all. Muawiyah continued to kill the Shia of Amir al-Mu'mini alayhi salam. Hujr bin Adi, killed by Muawiyah. Amr bin Hamaq al-Khuza'i, head paraded by Muawiyah. Rushad al-Hajari, killed by Muawiyah. Others of the Shia of Imam Ali alayhi salam massacred one after the other. That was number two. The third point in the treaty. What was it? You do not change the sunnah of my grandfather, peace be upon his family. You do not change that sunnah. Did he change the sunnah of Rasulullah or no? many areas, Muawiyah changed the sunnah of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon his family, to the extent that one narrator says they even prayed Salat al-Jum'ah on a Wednesday. Tell me, why is it called Jum'ah if we're praying it on a Wednesday? As in, if the Salah is called Jum'ah, why am I praying it on the Wednesday? Amongst other areas where he changed the sunnah completely. But number four, what was the fourth term of the treaty between Imam al-Hasan and Muawiyah? The fourth term was that you, after you die, the leadership comes back to me if I am alive. And if I am not alive, who does the leadership go to? Who does it go to if I'm not alive? Imam al-Hussein. That was the fourth condition in the treaty. Look at the Treaty of Versailles and the treaty with Muawiyah and Imam al-Hassan. The fourth condition, after I die or you die, it comes to me. If I'm not alive, who does it go to? Imam al-Hussein. Muawiyah, just before he died. If you notice, Imam al-Hussein lived with Muawiyah for 10 years as Imam. Never once did Imam al-Hussein fight Muawiyah. He began to speak out when each term of the treaty was being broken. Because Imam al-Hussein realized that this is only going to head in one direction. This person has signed a treaty with us. He's broken each one of the treaty. When you begin to break treaties, your arrogance becomes at a level where now you think that I can just destroy anyone. As in, when Hitler invaded Poland, he said, what are you going to do about it? When Hitler made an alliance with Austria, he said, what are you going to do about it? When Hitler stopped paying back, what? Likewise, Muawiyah said, I'll kill the Shia. What are you going to do about it? And I'll change the Sunnah. What are you going to do about it? And likewise, I will curse your father every week. What will you do about it? Look how he kept on telling Imam al-Hussein. Imam al-Hussein, not once did he reply back to him. Until when? Until Muawiyah broke the last term of the treaty. What was it? That after you die, it comes to Imam al-Hassan. Okay, Imam al-Hassan died 11 years before Karbala. Not 1 year or 2 years. Imam al-Hussein was an Imam of Ahlul Bayt for years before Karbala happened. Imam al-Hassan died. Okay, as Imam al-Hassan died, Muawiyah, now I'm alive. I'm going to wait for you because you're not dead yet. I'll wait until it comes near your death and we'll see. Muawiyah, when it came near his death, he made it clear to everybody that I announce for all of you, Yazid, my son, will be my successor. People turned around and said, but wait, there's a treaty. Like they told Hitler, you have a treaty of Versailles that's signed. You signed a treaty with us. Likewise, they said to Muawiyah, but there's a treaty. It says that after you die, you give it to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hassan and Imam al-Hussein both knew he wouldn't. But you could not expose him unless you make a treaty and then you expose his character. How did Rasulullah make the Hudaybiyah treaty? He said, these Quraysh, when his companion said, let's kill them. He said, no, relax. Let's do a treaty with them. You'll see their hypocrisy from the treaty. That they'll break the terms of the treaty. Likewise, Muawiyah appointed who? Muawiyah appointed Yazid. The moment Muawiyah appointed Yazid, the last term of the treaty was broken. Imam al-Hussein said, a man like me does not pledge allegiance to a man like you. No chance. We signed a treaty with you. And we asked you to honor that treaty. Now that you've broken all the terms of the treaty, there is no way whatsoever that you're going to have people like us pledge allegiance to you. Therefore, the second similarity between the Holocaust and Karbala, two treaties were broken. The third similarity, that there were people who paved the way for the Holocaust and Karbala to happen. What do I mean? Hitler could not do the Holocaust by himself. Do you agree? Can one man kill that many millions of people by himself? I ask all of you. Can one man send that many people to Auschwitz and see them burn and die? Can one man collect all of those ladies and all of those children? Can one man go towards Austria, go towards Poland, and go towards other parts of Europe and leave a dominant effect? No way. There are those who paved the way for him to dominate. Who were they? You find, for example, somebody like Paul von Hindenburg, who said that I will never allow Hitler to take a post. And then, when it looked better for him, he said, here, Hitler, have this post. Had someone like Paul von Hindenburg stood up and said, for example, that I will not allow this man to come into power. A man like you does not deserve to be at the helm of this great country. Germany should not have someone who's a fascist or who's a racist like you are. Not just a racist towards the Jews, by the way. A racist towards the communists. A racist towards Jehovah Witnesses. A racist towards the black community at the time as well. As many of you would have seen when the Olympics was taking place, the racism that he had against black athletes as well. But Paul von Hindenburg just stepped aside. Had he stopped Hitler from becoming chancellor, from having those positions, Hitler could never be there. But when oppressors rise, it's because of the silence of the good people. Yes? The silence of the good. That's why an oppressor rises. Had he stood up and said, you can't, the Holocaust would not have happened. Likewise, Hitler needed men around him who could support his ideology. Like who? Many of you would have studied Joseph Goebbels, for example. Or others would have studied people like Goering. These people were parts of the Nazi party. They needed to write the hadith to justify his position. Do you know where I'm heading? Yes. They needed to write hadiths for Hitler. That Hitler loves Germany. That Hitler wants the best for Germany. That the Aryan race is the greatest race. And that it should be honored and it should be protected. Hitler does not emerge. There are those who paved the way for Hitler to dominate. Likewise, Sayyidah Zainab said to Yazid and Sham, those who paved the way for you to dominate over us. Yazid, what you did at Karbala wasn't just you. It was paved many years before you. Yes. Yazid could not have done what he did at Karbala, nor Hitler could have done what he done with the Holocaust if it wasn't for those who paved the way for Yazid. Who paved the way for Yazid? Firstly, you had people who had appointed Muawiyah to be governor of the whole of Sham many years before Karbala. The second Khalifa, he is the one who put Muawiyah as the head of Sham. In which year? 20 after Hijrah. I ask all of you sitting here in this hall, is there no one better to be governor of Sham than Muawiyah bin Abi Sufyan? As in all those companions of the Holy Prophet who had given their lives away, was there no one better than Muawiyah? Muawiyah in the 20th year after Hijrah. By the way, he had just become a Muslim a few years earlier. Muawiyah in the 20th year after Hijrah becomes governor of Sham. Sham today is where? Syria. Sham in those days is where? Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, Jordan. Imagine you're in charge of all those four. But who put you in charge? Why? Why the son of Abu Sufyan takes the whole of Sham? The first person who paved the way for Karbala to take place was the one who appointed Muawiyah to be in charge of four countries. Syria was Muawiyah's. Palestine was Muawiyah's. Lebanon was Muawiyah's. Jordan was Muawiyah. The second Khalifa is the one who put Muawiyah in charge of these areas. Then number two, you have of those caliphs who came after him, those who started to put Bani Umayyah in wonderful positions. Yazid could not have come in unless his cousins were in before him. Do you agree? Marwan ibn al-Hakam, here's a position for you. Sa'id ibn al-As, here's a position for you. Here's a position for the other members of Bani Umayyah. Yazid doesn't just emerge. There are members of Bani Umayyah who, like a chessboard, were being placed with the intention of destroying this religion. Believe you me, Imam says in Nahj al-Balagha, and then you bought your Umayyad brothers one by one. So they began to devour this religion. In Nahj al-Balagha, Imam says that the reason that the people had a problem with the third Khalifa, what was it? That, hold on a minute, buddy, we're trying to understand something. That Marwan ibn al-Hakam, the Holy Prophet done la'na on him. How comes he's got a position now? Walid bin Uqba, Samara bin Jundub, Basr bin Artat. All of a sudden, Bani Umayyah and their henchmen were slowly coming in. Yazid did not do Karbala by himself. Karbala, there was a plot to have Karbala happen. years before Karbala took place. The same way Hitler could not have done what he done by himself, nor could Yazid have done what he done by himself. And that's why I say that Zainab says, oh Yazid, those who paved the way for you to dominate over us. Those who paved the way, Zainab was saying to Yazid, it's not you. Yazid, you're the one who sat in a position and put the final push button. There are others who built the machine for you already. Therefore, the third similarity were those who paved the way. The fourth similarity, both the Holocaust and Karbala involve the killing of innocent women and children. You find when you come to the Holocaust, why do you think they done the Nuremberg Code of Medical Ethics? For what reason? Many of you would have studied the Nuremberg Code of Medical Ethics. That code was instituted because of the way that children in the Holocaust were abused.
Yes.
In the Holocaust, many millions of Jewish children were abused. In which way? Where medical experiments were performed on them. Medical experiments, as if they were guinea pigs. You take a three-year-old and you put a particular injection in her. Like a guinea pig, a three-year-old, I ask all of you, a three-year-old deserves to be tortured in this way. A three-year-old deserves to see her fathers killed in front of her. A nine-year-old deserves to be burnt. What does Holocaust mean? Holocaust, holos kostos, a complete burning. What happened in the Holocaust? They would burn women in gas chambers. They would burn children. Children would be taken to gas chambers. And they would be burnt alive, all crammed in one area. Where were their men? Their men were taken sometimes in front of them and killed. May Allah never show you your father beheaded in front of you. All of you know where I'm heading. History repeats itself. What happened with the Holocaust happened with Karbala. A child in the Holocaust used to see the father beheaded in front of her and his killer on top of him shooting him. And she calls out, my dear father, come to me. My dear father, help me. There were women in the Holocaust, and these women were thrown in gas chambers. Why do people still go to Auschwitz? Auschwitz! It happened how many years ago, my dear brothers and sisters? 80 years now? Does not matter when an event happened. It could have happened a million years ago. The lessons are alive in our hearts until today. The lessons of what happened 80 years ago in Auschwitz, it doesn't matter if Auschwitz happened yesterday. It's a lesson for all of humanity, isn't it? A woman. Woman, children, many of them tortured, beheaded, burnt. Nobody there to look after them. Nobody there to protect them. And what else? Taken from prison to prison, from Poland to Austria to Germany, from one prison to another, from one darbar to another. Allah, from one prison to another. From one house, which is not their house, to another. You cry because women and children in any battlefield, there is a law that the woman and the children are meant to be protected. Don't you all agree? As in the trees should be honored, the woman should be honored, the children should be honored. If you have any sanctity for animals, honor the animals at the very least. These are all rational human laws. I don't need to be a Muslim to believe in them. Do you agree? I don't need to be a Muslim for me to believe that the woman cannot be somebody attacked on a battlefield, or that the child should not be attacked. In the same way in the Holocaust, you had women and children killed. Look at what took place at Karbala. Holocaust means what? Holocaust means complete burning. I ask you, when Sukayna bint al-Husayn ran from tent to tent, and I haven't even got to my masa'ib yet, human history has moments of masa'ib we should all share in British society. My Jewish neighbor and my Muslim neighbor, all of us have to share our grief with one another and look for our similarities with one another, living in such a wonderful pluralistic society that we live in. When Sukayna, the daughter of Abu Abdullah, ran from tent to tent. And what happened running from tent to tent? Her dress was on fire. Hamid bin Muslim, one of the chief narrators, He said, I saw a girl running from tent to tent and her dress was on fire. I came to her and I said to her, here, have some water. He said, after I had put out that fire, I said, have some water. She said to me, oh man, are you with us or are you against us? He said to her, I'm neither with you nor am I against you. She said to him, how could you offer me water when I saw my father beheaded with no water? Allahu Akbar. Holocaust is a complete burning. Did they not burn the children of Imam al-Hussein in Karbala? Holocaust is when you see your father's head in front of you. When Ruqayya fell on her father's head, yes, what happened to her, that young girl? Holocaust is when women are attacked and hit and slapped. I wonder, Zainab had already seen one slap in Medina on her mother's cheek. 50 years earlier, she saw Fatima's cheek red. I ask you, how many times did they slap Zainab alayhi salam? I'm going to narrate this to you. The fourth Imam says, not just they slapped my auntie Zainab. He said, I saw them poke their spears in her waist. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. They poked their spears. Those of you who want to be in Sham tonight, read your dua to go to Sham soon, inshallah. There are many of you I know listening around the world. Many of you wish you could go to Sayyida Zainab Ziyarah. I know there are many here who have not been for a number of years. In the Holocaust, they got those women and they would kill them. And they did the same in Karbala. You look at, for example, Wahab al-Kalbi, his wife, killed in front of him. Therefore, likewise, the Holocaust saw women and saw children killed, tortured, burnt. Likewise, in Karbala, there were women who were tortured, who were killed, who were burnt because of the tents of Bani Umayyah and what took place. After that, what do we find? Were there those who lived to tell the tale of what happened in both? Yes. In the Holocaust, there are over 200,000 survivors of the Holocaust. They lived to tell the tale. Otherwise, how would I know what happened in Auschwitz? How would I know what happened in Poland or in Austria? How would I know? There would have to be people who lived to tell the tale. Many of you would have heard of Anne Frank and the diaries of Anne Frank. Anne Frank, her diaries in the Dutch language originally, would be able to portray for us a picture of what took place with Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. Until today, that work survives. How does it survive? Because number one, Anne Frank had seen what these genocidal maniacs were, that was the Nazi party. Number two, she was able to live to tell the tale. If not her directly, then at least her father. Number three, translated into many different languages. Until today, the diaries of Anne Frank, you can find them in many different languages, where people are able to learn about what happened in the Holocaust. Because someone could easily say, how can I believe that's what took place? I was born, for example, in the 1980s. Some of you were born in the 1970s. So we don't know what took place between 1939 and 1945 with the Holocaust. No, there were people who survived some parts of the Holocaust. They wrote their notes. There are others who managed to talk about what took place with the Holocaust. They were able to tell us about the horrific scenes that took place. Some of them were wives of people who were killed. Some of them were children who had survived. So therefore, you find that with the Holocaust, there were those who lived to tell the tale. Likewise, Karbala. How do I know what took place at Karbala? I wasn't at Karbala, so how do I know it's all true? Because there are those who survived. And those who survived made sure that they told us what took place. Yes. There are those who survived. For example, who survived? Amongst them, our fourth Imam survived. And he narrates, if you saw Ash-Sham, if you saw what happened. Because you know, he met Jabir bin Abdullah al-Ansari after Karbala. He met him in Karbala. He said, Jabir, I wish I could tell you what we saw. Abbas's right and left went. Allahu Akbar. Jabir, I wish you saw the neck of the 6-month-old. They took the neck completely. Jabir, I wish you saw Qasim's body and what they did to it. Jabir, I wish you had seen the way they hit my younger sisters. Jabir, Akbar called to his father, help me. Jabir, if you had seen Shimmer on the chest. Imam Zain al-Abidin survived Karbala. He lived to tell the tale. Like others survived the Holocaust. Who else survived? Imam al-Baqir, 3.5 years old. He said, if you saw Ash-Sham, they poured boiling water on the head of my father. When he was walking from the top, they poured boiling water on his head. How would we know this? Because Imam al-Baqir lived for how long? He lived for over 50 years after Karbala took place. Okay? Who else? Sayyida Zainab. Anne Frank had her diaries. Zainab had her books. Zainab had her sermons. That sermon of Sayyida Zainab, you shed the blood of the progeny of Abd al-Muttalib. That sermon alone, O Yazid, you disgrace us by unveiling our faces so that all could see us from the noble to the ignoble. While there is none to defend us, that sermon showed us that the ladies of Al Muhammad, amongst the things they did to them, was physically take off their scarves that they were wearing. Yes. Whether that scarf is a head covering or it's a face covering, there was an attack on the ladies of Al-Muhammad, no doubt. Likewise, you had wives of the companions of Imam al-Husayn, like the wife of Zuhair ibn al-Qayn. Daylam was with the army in Karbala. She saw everything. Her husband Zuhair was killed in front of her. And she narrates, she says, on the afternoon of the 10th of Muharram, after they had killed Imam al-Husayn, we reached Sham Ghariba. And when we reached that night, all of us ladies were trying to sit with Zainab alayhi salam. Imagine, said that we had not been used to living. There was no Husayn and no Abbas to look after us. We were alone. May Allah never show you a group of ladies alone in the middle of the wilderness, no one to help them. She said, all of a sudden, I remembered my husband Zuhair. She was telling people that night what happened. She said, I remembered my husband Zuhair. And when I remembered him, I asked my servant who was next to me. I said to her, if you don't mind, please, can you do one thing? Said, what is it? Said, here's a piece of white cloth. Go and cover Zuhair, my husband's body. She said, my servant went out into the middle of the plains of Karbala. And then shortly after she came back, I said to her, did you cover his body? She said, no. Said, why? Listen to these now. Because someone had to live to tell us what happened. She said, I was walking to his holy wife. She said, I was walking to his holy body. I was about to cover it. And I turned. And I saw the holy body of Abu Abdullah without a kafan on him. So I thought to myself, how could I cover Zuhair's body? And the son of Fatima al-Zahra dies with no kafan on his body. How would we know this musibah? We know it because of Zuhair's wife and the wives of others who survived Karbala, Qasim's mother and Rabab and others who survived. Therefore, the Holocaust had people lived to tell the tale. Karbala had people who lived to tell the tale. Question arises, where was God in the Holocaust and where was God in Karbala? Yes. How could God let Hussein's body be trampled on by horses? Where are you, God? You claim, O God, that you love this family, Ahlul Bayt, but you saw their bodies trampled on. Where were you in the Holocaust, O God, when all of these children and their millions and women were taken to gas chambers? On this note, is it better to have an atheist belief or is it better to believe in God? An atheist belief, well, it doesn't help when we look at the Holocaust or Karbala. Why? Because then all we boil it down to is survival of the fittest. One group was more powerful than the other. And in the world of the dialectic, if you're more powerful than the other, then you triumph. Simple as. And another group can fight another. That's survival of the fittest. So when Hitler done what Hitler did, and an atheist worldview, what's wrong? Hitler was more powerful than you, and he put millions of you into a gas chamber. Live with it. In an atheist worldview, when I look at Karbala, so what? Yazid was more powerful, and that's it. He won. And the more powerful continues to exist. And there's a day when Yazid will fall. And it's as simple as that. In a godly worldview, there's a recognition that you may, in front of the people on that day, seem like you lost. But years later, many will call your name and many will forget them. Why? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala shows us moral, ethical principles will always live. And the principles of oppression and atrocity will always be by the wayside. Secondly, if Sayyida Zainab did not see justice at Karbala, then a belief in God tells me there'll be a day of Qiyamah when justice will come. Isn't that true? The atheist would say what? So what? It happened. Human beings are animals. They fight each other. Eventually we'll all rot. The godly monotheist says no. We were taught lessons in sabr at Karbala. Lessons in patience and perseverance. We were taught how to have dignity in the face of oppression. In one afternoon, we learned what it meant to follow the manifestations of God on earth. Hussein bin Ali's patience and Zainab's dignity. Abbas's sacrifice. Ali al-Akbar's honor. All of these principles allow me that when I believe in God, I look at them, I see nothing but beauty at Karbala. Karbala looks beautiful to me. If I was an atheist, I'd just say it's two people fighting. One's more powerful than the other. We all live in a jungle. If I believe in God, I say thank you, God, for letting me know Aba Abdullah. Did we learn from what happened at the Holocaust? And did we learn from what happened at Karbala? No, we didn't. It's sad. You'd think the Holocaust would make people never commit another Holocaust. Even Holocaust survivors today say it's a shame about the Holocaust that's being meted out in the Middle East. Holocaust survivors, not me. Holocaust survivors look at innocent children and women in certain parts of the Middle East. And they'll say, this is not right. We are the people who saw Hitler do this to us. How then, when Hitler has done this to us, could we then ever come to a stage where for the sake of land, all of us are willing to kill innocents? For the sake of land? It's a shame when we study the Holocaust and you find that people did not learn from the Holocaust, did not learn from what took place. Likewise, did we learn from Karbala that there will never be another Karbala? There were many Karbalas after Karbala. 100 years after Karbala, you found again the grandchildren of Rasulullah killed on the outskirts of Mecca in what Imam al-Radha and Imam al-Jawad called the second Karbala. If you want, go and study it online. Waqi'at al-Fakh. Fakh, outside of Mecca, they gathered all the grandchildren of Ahlul Bayt and beheaded them one by one. The second Karbala. Then there was a third Karbala where you'd think we would have learned as Muslims that we do not have another Karbala. That Karbala was a one-off. The massacre of those women and children and all those great personalities wouldn't happen again. Only 200 years ago, Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab and his henchmen massacred Karbala on Eid al-Ghadir. Massacring thousands. Many do not even read about this. That in Karbala, they had gone out with full force. And they destroyed Karbala. And they tried to destroy. Did we have another Karbala? Hussein Kamil Saddam's son-in-law comes to Karbala in Iraq in 1991. In front of the grave of Imam al-Hussein, it's attributed to him that he said, I am Hussein and you are Hussein. What are you going to do? And he began shooting the grave of Aba Abdullah. And they massacred the whole of this Karbala. Did we learn as Jews and Muslims from the Holocaust or Karbala? Sadly not. A Holocaust continues in one part, in some cases, not in all. Again, I don't want to generalize all. There are many people who are against such things. And likewise in Islam, you find a regime that was honored to live on the blood of killing Rasulullah's grandchildren and destroying the graves of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt in Jannat al-Baqiyah. Therefore, have we learned? Sadly, we have not learned. Had we learned, then we would never have reached a stage where we're willing to enact these two actions again. What's the difference between the two? There's a major difference. There are a few which are clear. At the Holocaust, millions died. At Karbala, three figures, one may argue in terms of numbers, died. One was in Iraq, the other was in Europe. But there's a third difference which is clear. What is it? The Holocaust survivors, in some cases, looked for recompense for what they went through. Some of them wanted a recompense, that we went through all these atrocities. There should be some payments given to us. There should be some money handed out to us. If I have a tooth from a Holocaust, I have some hair from the Holocaust, I have lost children of the Holocaust, then I deserve some recompense. It's not right that I went through what I went through. In a way, one can understand this, that when a person in any war-torn country, even Iraq today, those who were refugees, the government gives them certain payments because they went through war. In the Holocaust, therefore, the survivors wanted recompense. I ask you, did any of those who survived Karbala ask for recompense monetarily? I ask all of you here in this hall, any of them? Do you know who headed them in the message that we don't want anything but the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Who? Zainab, daughter of Ali. At the end of her sermon in Sham, she could have turned around and said, listen, I expect recompense, because Yazid said to her, said, Zainab, what do you want? Because her sermon destroyed him. What do you want? I'll give you what you want. She said, you can never give back what you took from me. Can anyone replace Abbas? Nobody can replace Abu al-Fadl. Can anyone replace that six-month-old baby? Nobody can replace these. Can anyone replace the glorious eyes of Aba Abdullah? Nobody can replace these. Yes. Can anyone replace the chest of Imam al-Hussein after those horses dug themselves into? Nobody can replace these. She said to him, Yazid, what you took from me, you can never give back to me. And in her sermon, she made it clear, I thank Allah for everything. All I ask, not recompense for me, but recompense for the shuhada of Karbala. That Allah honors them. That's all I ask. Did Allah honor them? Every year we say, wa ala ashab al-Husayn, in our salams. Every year in our salams, we say, Salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah, wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifinaik, wa anakhad birahlik, alaykum minni jami'an, salamu allahi abadan ma baqitu wa baqi al-layl wa nahar, wa la ja'alahu allah akhir lahdi minni lizatikum, as-salamu alal, as-salamu alal, Hussein, wa ala, wa ala, wa ala, ashab al-Hussein, that's all she asked. Those people who helped Aba Abdullah, all I ask, Ya Allah, look after them. Those people gave everything away to Aba Abdullah, honor them. And you would think that if anyone deserves to ask, it's Zainab alayhi salam. Considering what Zainab went through, she could have easily turned around and said later on, someone give me money for what I went through. I lost Aun and Muhammad in front of me. I lost my family in front of me. They slapped me in Kufa. They kicked me in Sham. I deserve to have someone look after me? Not at all. She said, Allahumma taqabbal minna hadha al-qalil. Oh Allah, accept from us this small, small sacrifice. Small. Karbala was small, ya Zainab. Zainab, Karbala was small. I wish now I could be holding the dharih of Zainab talking to her. How many of you wish this? I wish now I'm holding her dharih. And I want to say to her, Bibi, Sayyida, Karbala was small. Bibi, I want to ask you, when Aun fell on top of Muhammad, what went through your heart? Bibi, I want to ask you, when you saw the arrow in that neck, how did you talk to Abu Abdullah? Bibi, I want to ask you, when Shimr kept hitting you, how did you feel? Yet she kept on calling out, "Oh Allah, accept from us this sacrifice. It's a small sacrifice." And yet when Imam Zain al-Abidin remembers what she went through, we know it wasn't a small sacrifice at all. On the contrary, what Zainab and Kulthum and the other ladies of Al Muhammad went through. This is the first night of Muharram. Bibi, if you're here in the crowd, and I'm a firm believer, Al Muhammad, come to the majalis. If you're here in the crowd, forgive me. Or the Imam of my time, forgive me. But there's one musibah that breaks me when I remember it. When they got you and Kulthum in the court of Yazid in Sham. That one breaks the heart. They had paraded them in Sham. They took them around everywhere. And then they sat them in the court of Yazid. Aqilat al-Talibiyin is now sitting as a prisoner in Sham. Narrations mention Yazid at that time, he was married to a lady by the name of Hind. Yes, that Hind, when she was younger, she used to serve where? She used to serve in the house of whom? In the house of Imam Ali alayhi salam. She was younger, she was serving in that house, very young at that time. And when she was young, she had seen all the children in the house, those who were older than her as well. But then later on, after Imam al-Hasan died, Muawiyah ordered her that she has to marry Yazid. And this poor lady was forced into this marriage. She had married Yazid. All of a sudden, her servant came to her. She said to her, "My lady," he said, "Yes." She said, "My lady, get dressed." She said to her, "Why?" She said, "We have a group of prisoners that have been caught." Allah, did we ever think a day when Zainab would be called the prisoner? How would her mother Fatima have felt had she seen her? The narrations mention that she said, "We have prisoners from where?" She said to her, "From an area called Karbala." She said to her, "Okay, very well. What does he want?" She said, "Get dressed. He wants to parade them in front of everybody." She said, "Why the parade?" She said, "Because they're a group of rebel troublemakers. So he wants to expose them." She said, "Very well." She got changed. She got dressed. She said, "Where is he?" She said, "In the court." She went and she sat on the throne. Zainab and Kulthum were on the ground. She's on her throne. While she's on her throne, Sayyidah Zainab looked up. Whatever I'm going to say now, may Allah give you sabr. Okay? Zainab looked up and then she looked at Kulthum. She said, "Kulthum, do you recognize her?" Kulthum said, "I don't, my lady. Who is she?" She said, "Do you remember when she was younger, she used to be serving in our house in Medina?" She said, "Yes." "Who is it, Hind?" She said, "It's Hind." Hind saw them whispering. She said, "Let me ask you something. Excuse me, where are you people from?" Said, "We are from Medina." Hind came off her throne, sat on the ground. Zainab said to her, "Why have you sat on the ground? You're sitting on a throne." She said, "Out of respect for the people of Medina." Allah. She said to her, "May I ask you something?" She said, "Yes." She said, "Do you know some of the families in Medina?" She asked Zainab. Allah, what had time done? Zainab, the granddaughter of Rasulullah, is being asked, "Do you know the families of Medina?" She said to her, "Yes. Who would you like to ask about?" She said, "You know, when I was younger, I served at the house of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Do you know him?" I ask all of you a question. How old did Karbala make Zainab look? What had Karbala done to Zainab? She said, "When I was younger, I served in the house of a man called Ali ibn Abi Talib. Do you guys know him?" She said, "Yes, we know him." She said to her, "May I ask you about some of the members of that house?" Allahu Akbar. This is all for you now, because you know where her first question is. She said to her, "May I ask you about some of the members of that house?" Sayyidah Zainab looked at her. She said, "Go ahead and ask." She said to her, "May I ask you about Abu al-Fadl? Where is Abbas? I beg you, tell me about Abu al-Fadl." Zainab turned around to her and she said, "Do you see in the head of that spear?" She said to her, "Yes." She said, "That's the head of Abu al-Fadl in front of you." Allahu Akbar. She doesn't know what to say now. And then she turned around. She said, "May I ask you?" She said, "About whom?" She said, "May I ask you about Aba Abdullah? Where is Aba Abdullah? I beg you, show me." Zainab turned around. What did she say? She said, "Do you see that head on that spear?" She said to her, "Yes." She said, "That's the head of Aba Abdullah in front of you." Hind remembers when she was younger, if Hussein was one side, Abbas was the other, Zainab would always be next to them. She said, "May I ask you, where is Zainab al-Hashimiyya?" Allahu Akbar. What does Zainab reply? She said to her, "If you're asking me about Zainab al-Hashimiyya, I don't know where Zainab al-Hashimiyya is. If you're asking me about Zainab al-Masbiyya, Zainab the prisoner, then here I am, Zainab, in front of you." When Hind realized that that was Zainab in front of her, she ran out of the court of Yazid. When she was running, her hijab fell off her. Yazid said to her, "Go and put on your hijab." What did she reply? "Oh Yazid, you tell me about my hijab. How about the hijab of the daughters of Rasulullah? You tell me about covering myself. Look at the cover of Zainab and Kulthum in front of you." Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Let's raise our hands with the tear flowing from the eye. Many of us have hajat in the hall tonight. Ya Allah, we ask you in the name of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, bring our religious communities and this country together closer than ever before. Allow us to share our moments of happiness as well as our moments of grief with one another. Ya Allah, allow us to receive the intercession of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with the Surah al-Fatiha, but before it, the loudest of your salawat. Allah.